we're ready. Good morning. This is Commissioner Susan Weefall. The commission is holding its regular meeting. Today it is 10 o'clock a.m. in the commission hearing room, September 10th, 2008. We're meeting today in Bismarck, North Dakota, in the state capitol building. With me are my two fellow commissioners, Commissioner Clark and Commissioner Kramer. We'll first go to Commissioner Clark and see if he has any welcoming comments.
Good morning and welcome. I'd like to welcome our new Director of Administration as well, a new face sitting in the Executive Secretary's chair, Daryl Nitschke. Welcome, Daryl.
Good morning and welcome to Daryl and everyone. I move passage of items in the consent agenda.
Second.
All in favor?
Aye.
Well done, Daryl.
Thank you.
All right, next we'll go to the items in my portfolio. SW1, there is a change in this motion, and so I'll go over that carefully with my fellow commissioners. I move the commission deem the application complete and issue a notice of filing and a notice of hearing in the applications of Just Wind Wind Farm Development for a certificate of site compatibility authorizing construction of a proposed, it reads on your motion, 357 megawatts of wind farm. That should be corrected to read 368 megawatts wind farm in Logan County, North Dakota, case number PU0754.
Second.
The accompanying notice to filing and notice of hearing also needs to be revised to include that same number. On August 1st, 2008, Just Wind Wind Farm Development filed a revised application for a certificate of site compatibility to authorize construction of a 368-megawatt wind farm consisting of approximately 160 2.3-megawatt wind turbine generators and associated facilities in Logan County, North Dakota. A public hearing on this application is scheduled to begin October 21, 2008 at 10:30 a.m. in the Logan County Courthouse in Napoleon, North Dakota. And the issues to be considered are, will the location, construction, and operation of the proposed facilities produce minimal adverse effects on the environment and upon the welfare of the citizens of North Dakota? Are the proposed facilities compatible with the environmental preservation and the efficient use of resources? And three, will the proposed facility locations minimize adverse human and environmental impact while ensuring continuing system reliability, integrity, and ensuring that energy needs are met and fulfilled in an orderly and timely fashion? There's a few things that I need to note here. One is that although the commission is scheduling this hearing today for October 21st, 2008, we are discussing this on admin. The company has asked us whether we can move up that hearing date. The soonest we can hold the hearing date due to our notice of hearing requirements would be October the 8th. Previously, the commission had looked at its schedule and determined that October 21st was the soonest date that we could hold that hearing. The company is interested in us moving that up because they're telling staff that they have equipment that's already being delivered next spring. So anyway, the commission will be discussing this on admin. The date may stay the same or it may change depending on what we decide on admin today. This is a major wind farm. 368 megawatt wind farm is much larger, of course, than the wind farm that we have already constructed at Langdon, which is approximately 200 megawatts at the present time. So 368 megawatt wind farm is a very large wind farm for North Dakota. This particular wind farm would be located very adjacent to the city of Napoleon. The area goes north of the city of Napoleon, east of the city of Napoleon, and south of the area of Napoleon in a rectangular-shaped fashion. The 160 turbines would be 2.3-megawatt wind turbines that are being planned for this. Those would be larger than other turbines that are presently in place in the state. And so this is a very significant wind farm, and this is a major step for them to be, for the commission to be noticing this hearing on this matter in Napoleon on October 21st.
All in favor?
Aye.
SW2. I move the commission award a contract to Altig Engineers, Inc. in the amount of $6,155.50 to conduct a structural survey of the Richard Rudd residence that was damaged during an AML emergency project.
Second.
Now, if you'll recall, we had talked about our intent to award a contract 2 weeks ago for this particular matter, and now we are actually awarding the contract. Their bid price is $6,155.50. Staff had estimated that doing this project would be around $13,500, and the other proposal and bid was $19,500. Everything seems to be in order.
All in favor?
Aye.
SW3, these next three items do not require a vote. They're just for informational purposes. The fuel cost adjustment for Montana Dakota Utilities. The fuel cost during September will be 2.566 cents per kilowatt hour. As a result of the change, the electric bill for a typical MDU residential customer consuming 750 kilowatt hours per month will increase by $1.68 for bills rendered in the month of September. For Otter Tail, the fuel cost during the month of September will be 2.21 cents per kilowatt hour. As a result of this change, the electric bill for a typical Otter Tail residential customer consuming 750 kilowatt hours per month will increase by 30 cents for bills rendered in the month of September. This is the first uptick we've had in Otter Tail's cost of fuel since around May of this year, and you can see the chart. This is where we were at the high point of the fuel cost adjustment early last January and February, and how the numbers have gone down since then. And now there's at this point when we're down at the bottom of the of this low point, we're starting to go up slightly again. All right, Northern States Power. As a result of this change, the electric bill for a typical, during the month of September, Excel's fuel costs will be 3.314 cents per kilowatt hour. Theirs is considerably higher right now than the other two companies. As a result of this change, the electric bill for a typical NSP residential customer consuming 750 kilowatt hours will increase by $2.65 for bills rendered during the month of September. SW4, I move the commission approve the turbine site plan changes filed August 14, 2008 by Iberdrola Renewables, Inc., FKA, PPM Energy, Inc., for its Rugby Wind Farm in case number PU0547 and recaption case numbers PU0547 and PU05305 to recognize the corporate name change.
Second.
Now, you remember that PPM Energy filed a case with the commission, a siting case, in 2005. And the commission issued a notice of hearing. We held a hearing. We cited this wind farm in 2005 and for PPM Energy. However, the project did not move forward at that time. However, now the project is ready to move forward, this wind farm, and the company now that is owning this project is Iberdrola Renewables, and they're planning to move forward with the Rugby Wind Farm. They needed to move forward. In order to move forward with this plan, they needed to bring in turbine site plan changes. Those were filed on August 14th of 2008 by the company. The commission had a chance to review these in an informal hearing, which was held 2 weeks ago. The changes were not major, and they look just fine to the commission. And so everything seems to be in order. This is a significant step for this wind farm near Rugby. People whose land this wind farm is on have been looking forward to this project. And they are, we had a few representatives of the community sit in on our informal hearing. And those people who were here indicated that they're very happy that the project is moving forward at the present time. And so we should have a wind farm going up in this area next year.
What precipitated the site plan change was a change in the actual turbines. The original plan called for 1.5 megawatt GE turbines, and they are using, I believe, they're 2.5 megawatt turbines. So obviously to get to 150 megawatts, you need fewer turbines. So fewer locations were required. By and large, the company used existing turbine locations, minus a few, obviously. But a few changes need to be made. A few moves had to be made to accommodate the fact that these are larger structures, obviously. But they did, I thought, an excellent job of keeping the footprint, of course, in place, keeping the changes very minor, and made a very compelling case, I think, to say the least. And it was kind of interesting, actually, I thought, commissioners, to have the new local economic developer and another community leader in the room, because they had nothing to say other than we're all for it. And that's mm-hmm. pretty fun.
I'm sorry I didn't mention this is a 150 megawatt project, and it covers approximately 46,080 acres in Pierce County, North Dakota.
What was most noteworthy, I thought, was the fact that really the tower locations didn't change much at all. In fact, I thought it was interesting that the representatives, I'd asked them if they had had any negative feedback with regard to changes or from the community. They said the only negative feedback they had gotten were from some landowners who were concerned they were losing towers and would be losing the payments from some of those towers. So the community clearly is very supportive of the project. As my fellow commissioners indicated, there were representatives from local economic development groups there. The other noteworthy thing was the indication from Iberdrola that they would, in fact, be moving forward with this project, regardless of what the status of their purchase power agreements were. In the past, we had always heard with regard to this project that what was holding it up was the fact that they hadn't actually signed a contract with the utility company to sell the power. They indicated they're still in those negotiations, but at a corporate level, there was a commitment to build the project, even if it was going to be done on a merchant basis. And a merchant basis simply means you build it basically speculatively and then sell the power into the open market. So they seem to be fairly firm in their commitment that this fall they would start doing the preparation work that they need to do to get those towers constructed in the next construction season.
It does appear market demand is creating more comfort level for investors. So mm-hmm. let's see.
We will put out the map on the table so that everyone can take a look at it. It's a large map. All right.
All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. And next we'll go to Commissioner Kramer.
Nope, you still got
it. I have.
Excuse me. Let's just look for SW5 here.
It's possible.
Maybe I need a copy of SW5. Thank you. All right. I move the commission issue a notice of hearing in the matter of Montana Dakota Utility Company's application for a certificate of public convenience and necessity to provide electric service at a location in Kidder County, North Dakota, in case number PU08693. I further move that this hearing be consolidated with the hearing previously scheduled for September 16, 2008, in case number PU08345. PU08346 and PU08347. Now, if you'll remember, on August 25th of 2008, Montana Dakota Utilities Company filed an application to extend electric service to lots 3 through 5 and 7 to 11 in the DACO, D-O-C-O subdivision located in Kidder County, North Dakota, near Steele. Submitted with the application was a request from MDU that the commission consider this application at the time of consolidated hearing already noticed for September 16th, when the commission is scheduled to hear similar applications filed by MDU to extend electric service to lots 2, 6, and 1 within the DACO subdivision in cases number PU08345, 08346, and PU08347. And on September 3rd, MDU notified the commission that it has no objection to hearing this matter in conjunction with the September 16th, 2008 hearing. All right. And so then on August 27th, this is with Chem Electric Cooperative of Linton, North Dakota. They filed an objection to MDU's application and requested that the matter be set for hearing. And they have no objection, however, to the commission hearing this matter in conjunction with the previously set September 16th, 2008 hearing. So we are planning to do a consolidated public hearing, and these are the cases that we know as territorial integrity cases. That's the type of cases these are. And so we have the standard issues that we generally have at these hearings, from whom do the customers prefer electric service, et cetera. Everything seems to be in order. It does seem to be reasonable, since this is in the same area, to hold these hearings at the same time, and it'll just be more information for the commission to consider at the same hearing.
All in favor?
Aye.
Next, we'll go to Commissioner Kramer.
Thank you. I only have one item, and it is a discussion item only, and it relates to cost of gas charges. First announcement being that Great Plains is decreasing its cost of gas charge by $1.76 per MCF compared to last month, so the cost of gas in the customer bill will change from $11.63 to $9.87 per MCF. For a typical representation of September, the cost of gas in the bill will be about $6.18 lower than last month and about $6.96 higher than September of last year. Interestingly, we are finally seeing those storage of natural gas getting above now the five-year rolling average. It's been a fair bit below in the supply side recently. So that combined with the falling crude oil prices, Gustav not having the impact in the Gulf Coast that they thought it might have, and just a beating of some expectations has caused a lowering of those gas prices. Similarly, NSP is decreasing their cost of gas charge by 67.98 cents per decatherm compared to last month, and it'll be applied for September customers, changing the residential customer cost of gas from $8.31 to $7.63 per decatherm. For a typical September customer, the cost of gas will be about $1.01 lower than last month and remains about $2.90 higher than September of last year. Again, the commodity cost of gas is down for the same reasons that I mentioned with regard to Great Plains. This, however, cost of gas charge has one difference in that September is the true-up time for NSP. That is that one time during the year when they make the adjustment for any under or over recovery during the year. So there's about a 10-cent increase in the annual true-up factor. One of the specific factors that we looked at and that staff worked with the company on was to ensure that this problem with the billings with the faulty meters that occurred in Fargo and Grand Forks did not somehow skew this true-up number. And so this particular true-up does include a $349,000 dollars that is expected to be recovered but has not yet been recovered from the rebilling and remaining revenue yet to be billed later due to this automated meter reading module failures. That is to say that this true-up operates under the assumption that yet to be recovered money from the rebilling process has been recovered. So that problem will not skew the true-up. That's all I have, Commissioner.
All right, go to Commissioner Clark.
I have two items in my portfolio, both related to grain elevator licensing. I move the commission issue an order in case number GE08740, granting the request of Hague Elevator Company, Inc., DBA Hague Elevator Company, to discontinue business at Hague, North Dakota, effective September 8, 2008.
Second.
This is the result of a request that was received by the licensing division. The elevator has been sold and will be licensed to North Central Farmers Elevator of Ipswich, South Dakota. There are no outstanding storage obligations.
No, we did.
All in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
TC2, I move the commission issue an order in case number GE08719, granting the request of North Central Farmers Elevator, Ipswich, South Dakota, to operate a 215,000 bushel grain warehouse at Haig, North Dakota, effective September 8th, 2008.
Second.
And they're back in business.
Okay.
But could you say Haig one more time? Because I'm not sure you're saying it quite right. That last time, the first time, it sounded right. Anyway.
All right, we need to call the roll.
All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. I'll work on my German.
All right. Now, that ends the items on our regular agenda today. There are no major announcements other than one that the Commissioner Clark made, where we're welcoming Daryl Nitschke as our new Director of Administration. And Daryl started work with us last Tuesday, and we're happy to have him with us. And so feel free to contact him if you have any questions regarding the commission and its work. All right, and now we'll go to the media and see if there's any questions.
Do you have any idea what the investment is in the Just Wind development?
I can get that for you. I don't have that number with me.
And do you know...
I have it with me, probably, but it's right. I'll have to look it up here.
The big brown folder.
This is kind of obscure, but do you know who's manufacturing their wind turbines?
Well,
we do know that. That's in there somewhere. Well, yeah.
Jerry, do you know that off the top of your head? Okay. It's called... 160 Siemens, S-I-E-M-E-N-S.
The reason I ask is that PPM is switching to Suzlon, and Suzlon's had some...
Well, the whole choice of turbines... Right. Yeah.
Also, do you have any idea what the... investment is in PPM?
We can also look that up for you, Dale.
Mm-hmm. Can you tell me what... I wasn't able to attend the work session yesterday about the meter problems. Could you try to summarize what was said?
Yes. Sure.
I'm sorry.
We do have a tape recording of the meeting.
Yes, it is.
Okay.
On the website, so you can listen for yourself.
I would characterize it this way, Dale. That is to say that it was a high-level, very technical, in-depth explanation of everything you've heard. I mean, you know, they know a bunch of meters went bad and that
the billing
got messed up, and they accepted quite vehemently the full responsibility for that part of the mess up. So I will have to say it was a very informative. It was cordial. It was also firm on the part of the commission as far as the discussion goes. There were 9 employees of XL Energy here. They brought just about everybody that could answer about any question we could come up with. And
They also brought in the meter. And showed us the part that had malfunctioned and had that available so that the commission could see exactly what had happened to the meters and why they failed.
Visually, it was pretty easy to see what happened. They had holes in the meter itself, the unit. Ice got in there and actually stuck the thing from rotating, and it broke the axle on it. And so it was helpful to see that, although it's from a... when something can be described to me mechanically and it makes sense, it's a pretty simple device actually that broke.
We are not engineers, so we recognize that.
But I mean, it was a frank discussion though too. I mean, in addition to the contrition, which was certainly there, you know, one of the things that I talked about, and I know the whole commission is concerned with, is having our staff and legal staff look at our actual rules, and were the bills sent out properly? Our rules discuss the manner in which a bill, an estimated bill, can be put out, but there's some language in there that's certainly open to interpretation about under what circumstances they can do so. So we also sent the word to them that, look, you know, we're going to continue to look at this.
We also expressed...
indicated whether... technologies are enough for
well,
customers.
Well, about these meters and mm-hmm. the holes in them that ice collected.
Yeah.
Actually, it was designed to have a little hole in it.
Okay.
It's designed to have a little hole.
Yes.
Yes.
And so they are they replacing are. All of the meters that had this design.
It's actually just the module on the meter that's being that created the problem that is being replaced. Now, interestingly, the manufacturer of these modules had a whole bunch of them readily available to replace the ones that broke, which indicates or implies to me anyway that this isn't the first time this manufacturer's had this problem. So one of the issues that I think remains somewhat of a mystery and a concern certainly is that the timeliness in the response is concerning. When customers bring an issue to a utility in December and the utility doesn't really recognize the massiveness of the problem for a couple of months, that raises some questions about why did it take so long to respond. And so we had as Tony said, very frank discussion on all of these points that Susan and Tony both have raised, and it remains an interesting case to carry out yet.
Was the you mentioned that this was a simple thing to explain. Does that tell you that it should have been avoided? I mean, if this is such an easy problem to explain, it probably.
Well, to me the key point is how does all of this relate to what they're allowed to do under our administrative rules with regard to billing? And there's one sentence in our administrative rules. First of all, it lays out under what circumstances a utility can estimate bills when a meter has stopped reading. And then there's a sentence at the end of that particular rule that says that these types of readings shall only be done where there is, I'm sort of paraphrasing now, but where there is a significant reason for doing so, a significant event, and it's not the fault of the utility company. And that's really, for me, the key question, because the rule itself doesn't say, it's not a negligent standard. It's not, was the utility company negligent and reckless in how they did this? Was it their fault, as opposed to the consumer's fault? It would seem to imply that the rule is relating to things like if a consumer tampers with it, then clearly they can...
Right.
They can estimate a bill, or if there's an act of God, like you get struck by lightning or something like that, then they can estimate. Or a snow. Yeah, I mean, it could be a number of things, but the standard in there is if it's not the fault of the utility company, and that's where I'm. I think the commission needs to go from here, and its investigation is how that rule applies to this particular circumstance and how the billings took place.
Is it the fault of the utility company if they hire a contractor that?
Well, if it's not, it's the responsibility of the utility company to get any reparations from the manufacturer. In the meantime, as far as the relationship between the utility and the customer, it is, in my mind, whether it's fault, the definition of fault in the rule seems to me to be more who's the responsible party. And clearly, when 4,400 faulty meters are applied to houses, it's not the 4,400 residents' fault.
What I'm getting at is that could... If the rule says, as long as it's not the fault of the utility, and it isn't the fault of the utility, it's just the fault of somebody they hired to install.
Well, that may very well be the legal argument they make. I mean, yesterday I don't think we were expecting. I certainly wasn't a legal response because this is really a legal question. But perhaps they'll make that argument. But there are counter arguments to make to that. That it's ultimately the utility company that is responsible for providing the service, and it's ultimately their responsibility to procure equipment that works. So I'm sure we'll have those discussions as we move forward.
Have they replaced all these meters?
They're in the process of doing that.
And the meters are located where?
On their businesses.
In which cities?
Oh, basically, I believe it's in Fargo and in the Grand Forks area, yeah. In the Red River Valley.
Just their whole service area then.
And it's interestingly, Dale, it's not like a contiguous new neighborhood, so to speak. It's scattered about depending on,
Well, it's 1 out of 10, basically, that had this particular problem. And so although they had these built-in places where snow and ice could get into these meters. Not all, not 100% of the meters had this problem occur. So that's why about 1 out of 10 meters failed.
But all of the meters, all of the meters that have this vintage of meter will be replaced.
That's right.
Whether they had the, exactly.
Because they could have it in the future.
Because they feel like potential.
Yes, exactly.
I'd even say likelihood, given the...
Who's the manufacturer?
Cellnet.
Yeah, C-E-L.
C-E-L-L-N-E-T.
And you know when they're going to have, when do they project to have the meters all replaced?
Well, we'd have to listen to that tape from the meeting yesterday, but I believe it was by the end of this year.
Right, prior to this.
Prior to this winter starting. I think they said November or something.
And I think the whole the total number was like 22,000, wasn't it? Does that sound right?
They did file a plan with us on it. Yeah. They can dig that out and it has the
specific. They have 4,400 faulty meters, but they're replacing 22,000.
We'll check the numbers for sure, but that's it's a much higher number than the 4,400 that had zero billings.
But to avoid meters of the same type.
Precisely. It is a rather specific type. It's not just the type and manufacture, but even the vintage. There was a design change in like 2002 or something, and these meters were first purchased in 2005. So they can identify specifically which households and businesses have this particular module attached to the meters. The previous designs did not have this problem, so it was a rather new design and vintage. Evidently was engineered for warmer climates.
Are the ratepayers going to be billed for A, the installation of the meters with the design flaw, and B, their replacement?
We asked that question yesterday. They indicated...
Well, specifically, those questions will all be raised as part of NSP's next rate case. I mean, right now, they just operate their utility company within the current rate design that they have. Potentially, that's an issue that can come up in a future rate case.
Well, when you asked the question, what was their answer?
Well, I'm trying to remember because a lot of information was covered yesterday, but they did answer that question on the tape. Maybe Tom can go back and listen to exactly what they're
I don't remember the question being presented exactly.
It's not
like
as if there
that,
would be a surcharge right now. So.
Well, I understand that. But
no, but I did ask that question, and so it is, they did have an answer to that question, and so if you'll get back to
them. They said they were still in negotiations, but it sounded like Cellnet was going to cover the time. But it's in that recording.
Yeah, that's right.
Oh, yeah, they were careful not to.
Rather, right. They had a very careful answer.
Yes, I mean that the ratepayers are going to get.
Jerry?
Was the question whether.
Yeah, he said ask if the ratepayers.
No, the question is XL Energy runs a utility business. They have installed faulty meters. Then these meters are replaced. You know, they have operating expenses. I imagine these go as part of their operating expenses. Are the ratepayers going to eventually pay for this whole snafu?
Yeah, I didn't think that. The question that was asked, will the manufacturer be liable for some of this? And they were very careful to answer, we're in negotiations with them now.
Well, I'm sure that they'll try to get money.
I would think so.
But if they don't, who gets it in the shorts? Is it the ratepayer?
Well,
an issue for a future rate case.
And that was a question.
Tony, when you were talking about the question about the administrative rules, are you saying that this is not, this case isn't closed?
Oh, no. It's not closed.
It's not closed.
No, and there's actually two rules that we asked about, or that I asked about specifically. One is that rule whether they were even allowed to bill in this particular manner in this particular case, given the rule. There's a second rule that relates to when non-definitive volume charges are sent out, that the rationale and the reason for how these are billed has to be clearly explained. And we had a lot of questions yesterday about whether this was clearly explained.
I don't
to
have any questions.
Well, yeah. We asked the questions, and I don't think there were a lot of good answers. These were very confusing bills that were sent out. We had people that were getting two bills on the same day that said different things. They didn't know which one to pay. I mean, you almost had to have a rather complicated crib sheet next to it to try to decipher what was going on. It took me probably 15 minutes of going back and forth between sample bills and the explanation that they had sent the commission to try to figure out what was going on. And I just can't imagine customers had a prayer of trying to figure out exactly the bill. So there were also questions just related to the clarity with which they sent the bills out.
That's precisely right, Janelle.
It's not their responsibility to do that. It's the utility company's responsibility to send out a clear bill that explains exactly what charges are for and why.
Customers are suspicious enough of their utilities without getting something so complex that even a PhD in economics can't understand it.
We understand that this has been very difficult for the customers in the Red River Valley that are served by Xcel, this gas metering and billing issue, and the commission is taking this issue very seriously.
If I could just kind of back up a moment, when did the utility become aware of this problem?
They became aware of it when customers started to call in and report that they noticed that on their bill they had used zero gas. And this was in the middle of winter, and they knew that this was an error. So they actually had customers contacting Xcel December, January, those months, saying, I was not billed for any gas this month. Would you please come and check my meter or find out what's wrong? Some of these same customers did not then have any no work was done on their meter for several months. Nope. And so we did ask yesterday, why when a customer calls and reports that their meter is not functioning correctly, why someone would not be out the next day? Why there shouldn't have been replacement meters available. They said they did not have enough service personnel to take care of all of the issues that were being brought to their attention.
Basically, I think the reason that the timeline got so strung out was you had a few calls and a few people noticing that something was wrong in about the December time frame. They started calling Xcel. But for whatever reason, and this is one of the things we discussed yesterday, Xcel didn't pick up on this trend for some period of time. It was in January, February, where they started realizing that they had a bigger problem on their hands. But for whatever reason, staffing, equipment supplies, whatever it was a number of months before these really started getting addressed. Where the commission started getting a flood of calls was as late as, really, it was about this midsummer, July time.
Well, that's when the billing started coming.
The billing started coming through.
Where they were supposed to be catching up with their...
Right, I mean...
Precisely.
Yeah, at some point during this, Xcel had indicated...
Yes.
Yeah, at some point in the process, Xcel had indicated, oh, we've got some malfunctioning meters and we'll be doing some, you know, estimated billings. But it wasn't until July that all these started coming out, and the commission got this flood of concerns from consumers, and that's really when our investigation ramped up.
They did provide a timeline, Dale. We can get that for you. A nice chart of their timeline of these things, beginning with the late January sort of one light bulb moment.
Okay. Anything else?
You have on the admin agenda a complaint about Tatanka Wind.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Yes, we do.
What is the nature of that complaint?
Yes. The commission had asked staff to draw up a complaint because Tatanka Wind, as any company that commission issues a siting order for, if there are any changes after the commission issues its order in a siting order in the locations of the towers for the transmission, they need to bring those to the attention of the commission. And so it is our understanding that some of those were not brought to the commission. And so we asked staff to drop a complaint on that matter.
Dave, there was a filing some number of months after the line was constructed where Tatanka indicated to the commission that, you know, we made some significant changes. We should have told you. Here they are. So, I mean, after the fact, they had told us, and that's what spurred the investigation and potential staff complaint.
That you're going to penalize them yet?
The decision hasn't been made, but we directed staff to draw up a proposed complaint.
Okay.
What kind of conclusions can we draw, if any, from fact that Iberdrola is willing to build a wind farm in North Dakota on spec.
I think you can conclude.
What kind of conclusions can we draw?
It shows that the market for wind is very good. And quite frankly, with MISO, Midwest Independent System Operator, and I'm going to look at Jerry to be sure I get this just right. So, wind, because wind has no cost for fuel, it is used first as a resource if there is a need for fuel in our region. Is that simplistic?
It always accepts the market clearing price, as I understand, when it's blowing.
And so, therefore, it is used as the resource of first choice. It's the lowest cost resource. Excuse me, Jerry.
There is a regional energy market ran by the Midwest ISO.
Mm-hmm. They're at the top of the queue. First project, one of the first projects in the queue. So that's why this project is moving forward at this time, too. We've heard about the long queues for other wind projects that want to interconnect with MISO and the studies that need to be done. This one is at the beginning of the queue.
Their position in the queue lineup might be the most valuable marketing tool that they have, quite honestly, given how compact that is or how
long the list is. Megawatts.
The other thing, Dale, it probably implies or indicates a strong confidence that the production tax credit will be renewed. I'm guessing. No, I think you're going to start seeing investments being made, even without that PTC presumption, perhaps. But it appears, at least in this case, at least in the short term, that there's an expectation that PTC will continue.
I think it also shows the development in the wind business model that there are a lot of different models that are coming out and proven to be successful. You know, when these first started getting, when we first started seeing wind farms, it was primarily the wind farm developers that accepted all of the risk, but they were requiring to get into some sort of contract with the utility. Now you see all kinds of different business models sprouting up. This one where, you know, the Tatanka wind farm was the first that we saw that was just on the merchant model where they're going to build it and sell into the market at whatever price they can get. PPM is now still looking for a purchase power contract, but is willing to try the merchant power concept, at least at first, to get it going. You see community-based wind projects, which are a little different yet. You see turnkey operations where the energy developer builds the wind farm and then hopes to sell the entire thing over to a utility company, a traditional utility company. You see utility companies themselves just deciding to build them and roll them into rate base. So I think it's a real maturation of the business model itself that you're seeing all these different avenues for getting into wind.
And these are all people who 10 years ago we didn't have any idea that they would exist. These are independent power producers. These are not the utility companies that have traditionally been doing business in our states. And so these are a whole new group, independent power producers, who are constructing the generation resource separate from the transmission and the delivery of electric services, and are providing those services and then are providing them to the market. This would not have existed when I came on the commission.
Right.
15 years ago, there was no group.
Well,
yes.
You don't see a lot of, that's a good point,
you
don't
see
a lot of merchant coal mines, but, you know, the Otter Tail, funny you bring that up, the Otter Creek proposed one by North American Coal actually has that same concept in mind.
Yes, and it does Westmoreland, the project that was being built down in Gascoyne. That was an independent power producer, all right? And you do see those all over the country still in existence and happening. It's just in North Dakota we see more wind right now.
We've been more vertically integrated.
Well, and the merchant power model, you know, has gone through sort of a boom and bust cycle. It had been really a hot commodity for some, you know, I don't know, this is maybe 8 years ago, something like that. Yeah, there was a
NRG.
Yeah, 8-10 years ago, everybody thought the merchant model was going to be the wave of the future. Everybody'd get into just producing generation, and there was a lot of natural gas merchant plants that were built, and they didn't go anywhere. A lot of companies lost a lot of money, and some went bankrupt, and some got spun off. But now what you're seeing is, especially with wind, a move back potentially to this merchant model, because you have so many states that are requiring wind to be in the mix, and so there's a built-in market for it. Now it's kind of a contrived market because it's government mandates, but there are buyers out there that need it.
Okay, and now one more.
I'm curious about there's a reference to, there's no fuel cost wind,
capital. There's capital. No. There's capital costs because you're building the wind facility. And you have the maintenance of the facility, but there is no fuel cost, all right?
Well, and there's the cost of the backup power, which right. is really the fuel cost for... Right. for
well, that's,
I mean, I've heard all these years about how, wind power is still more expensive than coal power, et cetera. And so I just needed to have you address the term free.
Well, the resource itself, when the wind is blowing, is free, all right? And so it just depends what other resources a particular utility or a region has available for backup when that wind isn't blowing. And, yes, you do have those costs. But for the wind itself, for that generation, it's, for the lowest cost in that
That's why when utility commissions like ours take a look at resource planning, we have to consider the entire package for providing power at all times when it's needed and when it's demanded by customers. So sometimes wind makes sense, especially when you're displacing perhaps natural gas-fired units that might otherwise run all the time. Sometimes if it's a baseload need and has to run all the time, it may not be the best option. So it certainly has a place, but you do have to consider everything that goes along with that package, including the backup power and remembering that companies still have to recover all their costs for the backup power that's built as well, whether it's running or not.
Speaking of resource planning, where are we with the XL?
Rate increase?
Oh, the commission has extended, staff let us know. XL needed 2 more weeks to file its final brief. Now that's expected in October 1st. I want to rule on this case before I leave.
She's been licking her chops.
No, it's not fair to a new commissioner to have to come in to take a look at a case and make a decision that is where the hearing's been held and all the information has been accumulated. And so I'm really not supporting. If there's any more requests for I would not go along with those, because this is ridiculous that a sitting commissioner would not then be able to rule on this case.
Deadlines are in October,
the
deadlines have basically been waived by the applicant, by XL. I mean, the deadline would have been some time ago, actually, under statute, but it's actually so XL that keeps asking for more time.
I am hoping that we can hold a work session the middle of October on this case, the commission. Take several work sessions to work through the issues.
I was thinking about the debate over the bill that essentially set out a fairly tight time frame for rate cases.
Mm-hmm.
Is it interesting to you that XL Energy lobbied for that bill?
Yes, they did.
And now they're saying
we need more time.
Yeah.
Well, one of the risks, Dale, there's actually a bill that passed 5-4 in the interim committee to shorten the time frame for siting pipelines from 6 months to 3 months. And what happens?
All siting.
I've actually gotten to the point where a quick answer is easy. It's just always no. So I don't know how short they want to make these things, but it's not generally to everybody's benefit to have a longer time frame in which to make a decision, because no is the easy decision.
It's just important to remember that the burden is still on the applicant, whether they have 3 months to prove it or 6 months to prove it. the burden doesn't change.
Okay.
Oh, I mean, from a utility company standpoint, it would seem to me that the timeline isn't quite as important anymore subsequent to that, the interim rate law passing. As long as they're getting their rate recovery in the interim, I don't know why the 6 months or four or five or whatever they'd wanted at one point would be quite as big an issue, and probably isn't for them.
We do like to do things as quickly as possible, too. It doesn't benefit us to have things laying around a long time either, but you do have to have enough time.
Okay. All right. Thank you very much for your interest. All right. The commission will meet for its admin meeting at 5 after 11.